Chapter 27. Confirmation of Marilyn Monroe being upset and speaking with RFK about her woes is provided by Kennedy press aide Ed Guthman, who told author Evan Thomas for his book Robert Kennedy, His Life, "Bobby was a wonderful person to tell your troubles to, and Marilyn called him a lot." Besides being Attorney General, RFK had become the vacuum cleaner for all of JFK's marital transgressions. Columnist Earl Wilson called RFK the Kennedy family's sexual policeman. This included policing the affair with Judith Campbell Exner, whom the president, hard to believe but true, shared with mobster Sam Giancana. Certainly the first and last time a president was having sex with a mafioso's girlfriend in American history. When she finally did admit the affair, Exner said, "The worst thing I did was fall in love with a married man, JFK. I kept my secret out of fear." Other women whom JFK used sexually and then threw away included Swedish socialite Gunilla von Post, 1950s, First Lady Jackie Kennedy's press secretary, Pamela Turnure, 1958, while she worked in JFK's Senate office, White House intern Mimi Alford, 1962, the same year Marilyn died, and White House staff member Priscilla Ware. Barbara Gamarikian, a press aide under the president, recalled a shocking moment when Jackie was speaking to a Paris Match reporter about Ware and said, "This is the girl who supposedly is sleeping with my husband," and the reporter was utterly taken aback. Ware and fellow staff member Jill Cowan, who also was a JFK sexual conquest, were affectionately known as Fiddle and Faddle. JFK's sexual partners also included actresses Marlena Dietrich and Jean Tierney, call girl Ellen Romich, sultry actress Anita Ekberg, journalist and suspected Soviet spy Inga Arvad, and Mary Pinchot Meyer, the sister-in-law of legendary Washington Post editor Ben Bradley. Meyer was murdered in Georgetown in 1964 in an execution-style shooting that has never been resolved. For whatever reason, JFK couldn't help himself, and his sexual appetite, one begun early in life, flourished even during his days as a United States senator. An eyewitness to one disturbing escapade was Bob Levitt, mentioned before as singer Ethel Merman's son. During a vacation his family took to Montego Bay, they encountered JFK and Jackie, and a dinner was planned with all attending. But Levitt told this author in August 2020, "There was one empty chair, the one JFK was to have sat in. It was situated between my mom and Jackie, and she was the pissed-off wife since apparently her husband had scampered off after another woman, a beautiful one that I had my eye on as well." Levitt added, "The vibe between my mom and Jackie was one of commiseration. But Mom was quite upset since she had a very low opinion of cheating men. JFK never did come to the table that evening, but I guess he and Jackie patched things up later." Folklore about JFK's sexual exploits abound to this day, some credible, some ridiculous in nature. In fact, Marilyn, perhaps in jest, perhaps not, is supposed to have said of her brief affair with the most powerful man in the world, "I'd rather have a president who does it to a woman than one who does it to the country." Joan Lundberg Hitchcock, a social butterfly from California who had a brief affair with JFK, put it this way. "He wasn't exactly monogamous. He went through women like a Russian tank." Credible accounts, many presented by best-selling author David Heyman in his book Bobby and Jackie, A Love Story, charged that during their honeymoon in Acapulco, Jackie spent most of her time alone while JFK bedded at least one of the better-looking women before returning to her side looking flushed. Heyman also hit Jackie with accusations, including an affair with actor William Holden, with her only complaint about his lovemaking that he was a registered Republican. Now RFK, mopping up after his brother, who had the audacity to cheat on the First Lady of the United States of America with acts of disgraceful adultery, had helped cut the ties between JFK and Marilyn. But it appears he did so with an ulterior motive. He had fallen for the sexy blonde who he'd discovered actually had a brain to go with her curvy body. Friends of RFK disputed that he had any romantic interest in Marilyn, or that he just wanted to bed her like his brother had done, but common sense, based on the type of conniving, immoral, and unethical type of person Bobby was, lent credence to his wanting a piece of Marilyn for himself. After all, each of the Kennedys, from father to son, were liars, whether they lied to their wives and children or to the American public when the 1960 election had been rigged. Through the years, many conflicting accounts of whether RFK actually ever visited Marilyn's Brentwood home have surfaced. One account, supplied by Marilyn's studio maid Hazel Washington and denied by RFK's family and close friends, detailed Bobby's visit with Marilyn, where she happily invited him in and the two of them talked in her garden. Washington did nothing to downplay the sexual charge between the two after they spent more than an hour together, 2 months before Marilyn's demise. This led, Washington said, to a long-distance relationship that she described as making love over the telephone, and I do mean making love, apparently based on hearing Marilyn purring about delicate sexual matters over the phone. Despite being a married man with several children, RFK was cheating on his wife, again disputed by family and friends, and he must have lied to Ethel about doing so. Bobby had the perfect excuse to visit Los Angeles, since he was keeping tabs on the potential film version of his book, The Enemy Within, which certainly further infuriated the mobsters his father and he had double-crossed. One excerpt from the book read, "They have the look of Al Capone's men. They are sleek, often bilious and fat, or lean and cold and hard. They have the smooth faces and cruel eyes of gangsters. They wear the same rich clothes, the diamond ring, the jeweled watch, the strong, sickly, sweet-smelling perfume." Bobby ignored the risk that exposure of the torrid love affair with Marilyn might hit the media or become known to RFK's mortal enemy J. Edgar Hoover, who already had enough damaging information on the Kennedys to fill 5 volumes. Despite denials by family members and loyal friends, Bobby apparently carried on with Marilyn like a schoolboy in love for the first time. The two rendezvoused at Peter Lawford's 14-bedroom Pacific Ocean compound, where neighbors watched them stroll along the beach during June and July, just 2 months before Marilyn's death. One neighbor, Lynn Sherman, a close friend of the Lawfords, said, "The official car drove up and you knew Bobby Kennedy was in town." Again, this account has been disputed, but given the accounts of witnesses such as Sherman, it seems quite credible. While the relationship appears to have been sexual, this was not the bite of the apple that would cause Marilyn to be in danger in August 1962. Like Kilgallen, who was about to publish a book naming names as to who masterminded the JFK assassination, Marilyn, according to various sources, was keeping several notebooks and a daily diary chronicling her conversations with both JFK and RFK, especially the latter. Some said these notebooks never existed, but Susan Strasberg, daughter of revered acting coach Lee Strasberg and a close friend of Marilyn's, remembered her as a great note-taker. This observation is bolstered due to the plethora of scratch pad, hotel stationery, and other paper trails left by Marilyn, as noted in the book Fragments. To be certain, one of the least known facts about the famous movie star, along with her being a voracious reader of books, as noted before, was her love for writing. Thus, little doubt exists that she would have chronicled the relationships with both the president and his younger brother from the moment they met. Locating the notebooks, and especially the diary, which was called a Diary of Secrets in the aforementioned Rothberg report, is certainly tantamount to retrieving Kilgallen's JFK assassination file, which, like Marilyn's writings, disappeared when Kilgallen died. To date, no one has ever acknowledged reading the file, although reports surfaced that Kilgallen shared either the file or notes from her interview with Jack Ruby with Florence Pritchett, who became Florence Pritchett Smith when she married Earl E.T. Smith, appointed in 1957 as ambassador to Cuba. Despite these claims, no credible evidence has surfaced that Kilgallen shared her evidence with Pritchett, who remained friends with JFK until he died. This said, there certainly was a connection between Pritchett and Kilgallen, since, when the latter vacationed, the former at times took over her On Broadway column. In fact, in August 1946, Pritchett's column appeared with the caption under the photo of her, "Diplomat's wife, Florence Pritchett Smith, has been an editor, publicist, and TV star, with her being called an expert on men and glamorous." In the Kilgallen column dated May 23, 1962, one may note her mentioning Pritchett's husband, Earl, is writing his story of the Castro Revolution with addenda by his wife, Florence Pritchett. Interestingly enough, in an undated column Kilgallen wrote about the Cuban crisis, she mentioned not only the Smiths but Jackie Kennedy, connecting the three people at, of all places, a discotheque. Immersed in the high-stakes world of the second most powerful man in America, it seems likely that Marilyn tried to impress RFK as he was trying to impress her. They could have spoken of civil rights matters, political views and candidates, the Russians, and, due to the timing of their conversations, the Cubans and the Bay of Pigs invasion. Without question, there is little doubt RFK would have spilled his guts about his plan to eliminate organized crime based on The Enemy Within, then in pre-production to become a motion picture. In fact, on September 23, 1961, 2+ years before JFK's death, the New York Times reported, "Paul Newman has been signed for the role of Robert F. Kennedy in a fictionalized film version of the Attorney General's book, The Enemy Within." Apparently, that project was never completed, and, in fact, no movie was ever produced based on the book. Other than two mobsters like Carlos Marcello that he was pursuing with reckless abandon, RFK was still just a second-hand Kennedy. But to Marilyn, he was a powerful friend, and to that end, according to Evelyn Moriarty, Marilyn's movie stand-in, she kept stacks of notebooks in her house and dressing room, praising Bobby for his attention to her. This account seems credible due to the accumulation of other evidence pointing in that direction, as noted. What exactly RFK told Marilyn will never be known, since when she died, the notebooks, if they existed, disappeared. But what is known for sure is the information JFK gave to Marilyn about the UFO controversy, his visit to a secret airbase where he viewed things from outer space. This clue, Kilgallen would have realized, leads one to infer both Kennedys shared more than lovey-dovey talk with Marilyn. Considering the Kennedys' egos, both JFK and RFK would have attempted to impress the sex object, whom they had learned was much more intelligent across the board than they could have ever imagined, certainly not the dumb blonde she was advertised to be at every turn. Little doubt exists that Marilyn's notebooks and the secret diary packed with recordings of important facts she learned from the Kennedys could have changed the course of history, just as the facts Dorothy Kilgallen had kept in her JFK assassination investigation file could also have changed the course of history. Besides their mutual interest in UFOs and their friendship and mutual respect, the two women held in their hands secret material that each knew could be lethal. Kilgallen certainly was intent on sharing it with the world through her upcoming book, but it appears likely that Marilyn never intended to let anyone read her notebooks, that is, until RFK became the second Kennedy to dump her. One may only imagine the mental anguish Marilyn experienced when Bobby turned the lights out on their close relationship. 20th Century Fox had destroyed any confidence in her acting abilities, and JFK, the man to whom she'd shown her love by singing Happy Birthday to him in front of the world, had suddenly called a halt to their relationship. Then, just as suddenly, RFK, in mid-July 1962, refused to take her calls when Marilyn needed her close friend's advice about how to square things with Fox and resume filming Something's Got to Give. Talk about a dagger to the heart. Talk about hitting someone when they are down. Talk about being a real bastard to the woman who had been intimate with him. Talk about displaying lack of any caring for a woman who loved him. This was Bobby Kennedy, the real Bobby Kennedy. In effect, he was the miniature Joe Kennedy in its worst form, the Joe Kennedy who lacked moral or ethical character, especially toward women akin to that of ex-President Donald Trump, the Joe Kennedy who passed on to his sons these character flaws, resulting in the Bobby Kennedy who had instructed his secretary, as noted, to inform Marilyn time after time when she called that Mr. Kennedy is in conference all afternoon. Mental abuse, for sure. This said, Marilyn, certainly no angel, flawed as she was with choosing, for the most part, other than Joe DiMaggio and arguably Arthur Miller, the wrong type of men whom she too often shared a bed with, must have truly believed true love had come her way with RFK. Were her hopes false ones that he might leave Ethel for her? Or did he lead Marilyn on so that she really believed her hopes of their having a life together were realistic? Regardless, if Bobby had succumbed to Marilyn's sexual charms, if the sexual policeman couldn't police his own behavior, someone would have to take over that job. Marilyn was no longer the pound of flesh JFK and RFK had enjoyed, but a political liability to the entire Kennedy family. On the personal side, if the details of Marilyn's affairs with JFK and RFK reached the media, then not only Rose Kennedy, Jackie, and Ethel Kennedy, but their children would have been embarrassed to no end. But neither Jack nor Bobby gave a damn, both behaving as sexual predators who demeaned women, in this case Marilyn, who had loved both of them. Certainly the timing for Marilyn to destroy the two men and their families was at hand due to the immediate risk that the media might expose the torrid affair. Teddy Kennedy, Joe's chosen successor as president after JFK and RFK, creating the ultimate Kennedy dynasty, was facing a senatorial primary, and the last thing he needed was a family scandal. One powerful person who would have been smiling if Marilyn had exposed the two Kennedys' affairs, along with other secrets, was none other than J. Edgar Hoover, who had been watching the actress for years, as noted in the FBI file secured by this author under the Freedom of Information Act. Apparently, Hoover had made it known that a certain file existed, which he dubbed as Especially Hot, chronicling every single aspect of the Marilyn and JFK-RFK flings. In light of Marilyn's early years, spent in orphanages and foster homes after her mother Gladys Baker had been committed to an institution and her father had left home never to return, her failed marriages, men using her for sexual pleasure and nothing more, and failed promises that she was really loved for who she was and not what they expected her to be, it is no surprise she had dipped into the drug world for help. And now Bobby, whose actions personified Marilyn being used and then discarded by other powerful men, had abandoned her, and despite attempt after attempt to reach him, he had cut her off, leading to many sleepless nights, insomnia at its worst. A woman possessed with demons of various shapes and sizes, Marilyn also worried about those in power who could use her to attack the Kennedys, as well as worrying about what the Kennedys were doing to her. Rumors circulated that RFK's mortal enemy, James Hoffa, had bugged her home, hoping to gain access to the telephone conversations she had with the Attorney General. Concerned that Peter Lawford might turn on him out of friendship with Marilyn, RFK ordered him to cut ties with Marilyn. Now she had lost Lawford as a close friend, causing her more anguish. When the end came for Marilyn, just as it had for Dorothy Kilgallen, the word on the street was that both of these impressive women, each displaying more integrity than any of the men who used them, were troubled for any number of reasons. In fact, despite Marilyn's heart hurting from the Kennedy abuse, she had much hope for a bright future. As noted, she and 20th Century Fox had patched things up, and she was ready to resume filming Something's Got to Give. A new contract had been signed, including a $1 million salary for a 2-picture deal that also permitted her more control over the director, the script, and other matters important to Marilyn. Predictably, Fox executives were excited with the new Monroe, stating, "God bless you, we're ready for you," after Marilyn told them, "You won't recognize me." Imagine a Marilyn Monroe who actually comes to the set on time. Such a comment recalls what Jim Doherty, Marilyn's first husband, said of her in his book The Secret Happiness of Marilyn Monroe. He recalled, "Norma Jean was late for everything. I don't think she really knew how long a minute was or an hour. She thought time was a rubber band." During their marriage, the lateness included Norma Jean's getting ready for any appointment or social gathering. He wrote, "It was because of her dressing process. She could spend an hour deciding what to wear and just as long bathing. Every move at such times was painfully slow." On top of these blessings, Marilyn had been offered more than $10 million to act in 4 Italian films. And, better still, a telegram was found on Marilyn's table in the hall of her home from Natalia Denisi Murray, New York representative of screenwriter Anita Loos, offering Marilyn a starring role in a new Broadway musical entitled Go-Go. Marilyn, despite her having the broken heart based on RFK's Cutting Short the Romance, very well may have accepted the invite since she had always dreamed of being in a play on Broadway. If that happened, she could be seen as the serious actress she always dreamed of being. It may be that Kilgallen also knew of Marilyn's boisterous 36th birthday party on June 1, 1962, just 64 days before she died. One look at the photos from the party, and it becomes apparent Marilyn is enjoying the company of crew members as well as Dean Martin and Wally Cox on the set of Something's Got to Give. The footage shows her alert and sharp, with no signs of any drug or alcohol issues. She's vibrant, as beautiful as ever, laughing that magical laugh of hers, just enjoying herself, especially when Martin pecks her on the cheek and Cox has the thrill of Marilyn sitting on his lap. Certainly the special handmade birthday card, signed by Dean Martin, Wally Cox, and the crew, also made Marilyn happy, as did the sparklers lighting up her lovely face. These facts and more may have certainly contributed to Kilgallen concluding that the real truth about what happened to her friend when she died had not been told. With her eye on the pulse of the entertainment industry on a daily basis, little doubt exists that Kilgallen knew about the good things happening in Marilyn's life. This said, if either Kennedy, RFK, or JFK would have personally visited Marilyn prior to the beginning of August instead of being cowards and just shutting the door, perhaps she would have never made it known that she might call the media to a press conference, as Gianni Russo detailed, and nail those whom she felt had betrayed her, although this potential was disputed as well. In fact, noted publicist Rupert Allen said, "It was crass, and in hindsight a tragic brush-off. Marilyn really wasn't that unreasonable. If RFK had just confronted her one last time, everything might have turned out differently." In fact, RFK may have done so, but the message he brought with him was not the message Marilyn wanted to hear. Just as Dorothy Kilgallen's enemies underestimated her intellect and willingness to fight those who feared her, recall an FBI file included agents calling Kilgallen flighty and irresponsible, Marilyn's enemies had made the same mistake. But when she let it slip to the wrong people that she might call a news conference and tell all about not only her affairs with JFK and RFK, but what she knew about the 1960 election being fixed by Joe Kennedy and other secrets JFK and RFK had trusted her with, she, like Kilgallen, was doomed to die. She just didn't know it yet, since even if she never intended to go through with the exposé, the threat to do so caused the clock to tick toward her death. And what about those notebooks Marilyn had kept? If her movie stand-in knew of their existence, having seen them at Marilyn's home and in her dressing room, then common sense dictates that the Kennedys knew about them as well. They were a weapon, for sure, similar to Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation file that included all the evidence she had accumulated during the 18-month probe of his death. Since motive to eliminate Marilyn was clear-cut, all that remained, if Kilgallen had been investigating Marilyn's death, was delving into means, opportunity, and benefit from the crime, the homicide detective's best friends when solving a murder. Benefit from the crime was an easy mark, since it was obvious that the three Kennedys, Joe, JFK, and RFK, could erase from existence the one woman who could potentially bring them all down. Only means and opportunity remained toward solving the mystery of who killed Marilyn and why. But first, it had to be established, Kilgallen would have known, that the actress was the victim of a homicide, that she did not die as the result of a probable suicide, as concluded by the medical examiner's report. Accounts provided by Marilyn's sister Bernice, if interviewed, would have been most helpful in any real investigation of Marilyn's death. But just as no members of Kilgallen's family, other than the drunken Richard Colmer, briefly, were contacted by the authorities when she died, apparently none of the authorities attempted to locate Bernice. If that had happened, if the three shrinks appointed to probe Marilyn's death would have followed up, they would have learned what Bernice wrote in My Sister Marilyn. The days following Marilyn's reconciliation with Fox executives were busy ones. She reads possible properties, scripts that are sent to her, and considers nightclub offers. She has frequent appointments with Dr. Greenson and Dr. Engelberg for an ongoing virus. She fills many hours with telephone calls to friends in New York. Bernice added, Marilyn has interviews and cover photography sessions with a number of magazines, among them Vogue, Life, and Cosmopolitan. Her trademark gaiety and energy seem to be missing from these days, but she is fully occupied and seems to be coping well, looking to the future. The events of the 2 days before August 5th give no hint of her coming death. In addition, and most importantly, Bernice recalled that on Friday, August 3rd, just 1 day before her death, Marilyn, 1, set up a meeting with her attorney Mickey Rudin for the following Monday to make revisions to her will, 2, made a reservation for that Monday with her hair designer, 3, told the composer of Funny Girl that she would be in New York City on Thursday, August 9th, to discuss her appearing in the musical version of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and 4, changed an appointment set for Saturday afternoon to Monday afternoon to view Lee Thompson's film. Summing up, Bernice wrote, I don't know what to think about all of the murder theories that have cropped up since Marilyn died. I think it was definitely not suicide. I have never believed that Marilyn deliberately took her own life. She was too excited about the things she was doing, especially the new home. She had too many things that she enjoyed doing. I certainly would like to see a thorough investigation. Certainly Jim Daugherty agreed with the call for a thorough investigation, writing in his book, I don't agree with the conclusions of the suicide team that investigated it. It was not probable suicide, as they finally decided. Of that I am firmly convinced. Marilyn's friend and lover, actor Marlon Brando, made his thoughts about the cause of her death crystal clear at the time. He told Variety, Everybody stopped work, and you could see all that day the same expressions on their faces, the same thoughts. How can a girl with success, fame, youth, money, beauty, how could she kill herself? Nobody could understand it because those are things everybody wants, and they can't believe that life wasn't important to Marilyn Monroe or that her life was elsewhere. Brando was right. Any objective view of Marilyn's activities on the days before her tragic death, her looking to the future, her seemingly being excited about several of the upcoming events she was planning, perhaps even a reconciliation with Joe DiMaggio, are not the signals that cause a woman to commit suicide. And in addition, would a woman who seems to be coping well and gives no hint of her coming death, a woman who has just moved into the home of her dreams with her beloved dog, take her own life?